Well, good afternoon. I want to welcome you on behalf of the Institute for Christian Worship at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. It's our desire to bring in musicians and pastors and scholars and Christian workers who can help us get a clearer look at what it means to worship the one true and living God as His people, men and women who have come to faith in Jesus Christ. Today we have guest lecturers. They are from Operation Mobilization, a missions organization, and the part of that great organization that deals with finding a heart language for Christians around the world through which they can express their love for God through song and worship. Bill and Robin Harris live in the Atlanta area right now, but have lived much of their life in Siberia, in Alaska, other parts of Russia, and in fact, their daughter is a concert pianist who really speaks Russian almost as a first language. So, such a thrill to have them here. At the break, we'll all look at their table outside where there are recordings and books that are a testimony of what ethnodoxology, ethnodoxology has done to further the kingdom of our great God. So would you help me welcome Bill and Robin Harris?
That's right, ethnodoxology. And the title of our session today is In Search of Heart Music for Churches Around the World. And we are going to start off with a clip, and we'd like you to work a little bit while you listen to the clip, and Bill will explain that.
Now, the clip that we're going to see is a famous classic from The African Queen with Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn. What we'd like you to do is watch the opening scene and ask yourself, if you were the missionary in this person's position, what do you like? What isn't working? What would you do the same? And what would you do differently? We'll have some comments about that right after the clip. So, what's working for you? Tell me about the church. The church is in the middle of a village. Does it look like the other houses in the village? What do the other houses look like? What kind of roofs? Let's not be shy. Yes? What kind?
Were they made out of shingles? They had thatch roofs, right?
Thatched roofs. Okay. How many other buildings in the whole village have a steep steeple like that church does? None whatsoever. Okay, so you get to the front door, check your spears at the door. People go in, we come inside, and what's happening there? We're in the middle of a song. Okay. Do you recognize that song? But not from the street. Okay. What accompaniment is going with the music? Okay, it's a piano or some kind of keyboard, a pump organ maybe, something like that. Okay, how are the people dressed? Okay, and how is the speaker who is conducting worship, how's he dressed? Just like them, right? Okay, now did you see a songbook in that service? You saw this lady, she held up this songbook. Does that imply that those people know how to read? Well, apparently not. Okay, what else? What else did you see there?
I think the songbook was upside down.
Yeah, they were kind of groaning out their noises. You didn't see. What didn't you see? If you were the church planter, you come in as a specialist, as a consultant, what would you advise to change? What would you have them do that they're not doing yet? Yes? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yes? Yes, he was singing in English. Uh-huh.
Yep. Very good.
Maybe
okay.
Singing their own language at the time.
Ah.
They didn't understand.
Okay. Okay. Did you see the enthusiasm in the song leader? He was definitely doing his best, wasn't he? Did you see the enthusiasm in the congregation? Okay. Well, that's what our talk is about today. What can you do to help a church look and feel more like it's from there?
Of course, what you saw was a fictitious reality. It's a movie that was made, and we can all laugh because it is a little bit caricatured. But the harsh reality is that what we, Bill and I, saw in over our 2 decades of ministry in Alaska and Canada and Russia is that the indigenous cultural forms are being lost as ethnic minorities become westernized. And so, I don't know if we've ever seen a situation that was quite that bad, but there are many situations that are very similar in reality. When we were in Alaska, we noticed that the people there, regardless of their ethnicity, whether they're Alaska natives or white folks, they generally sing only country gospel songs. Pretty much that's the general trend of what's happening there. In Canada's First Nations churches, the non-Indigenous forms are so integrated into the local culture's perceptions of right worship that really it will take drastic measures for Indigenous forms to begin to take root, even in the new church plants. One missiologist says it this way: although the people are usually conscious of the fact that they are practicing a foreign religion, they think that's the way Christianity was intended to be.
Talking about Yakutia now for a moment, where we lived for 6 years and also in later in St. Petersburg, we saw that Russia is tremendously open to the gospel, but the churches that are being planted in Siberia are mostly being planted by Ukrainian and Russian missionaries going to the Sakha people. So it's kind of interesting to see what Americans might look like from the side. These were Ukrainian missionaries. And they tended to be very sender-oriented, just as the African Queen movie showed. Sender-oriented, not receptor-oriented.
The fruit of that is that the Russian Orthodox Church has had a lot of ammunition to call the Protestant church plants all kinds of nasty things. They call them the destructive Western sect. They have, because of this xenophobia, that they're really afraid of all this destructive Western stuff that's coming in, they are beginning to actually shut down access to halls. They make it difficult for us to actually rent venues and things like that. So it's a real problem, because the Western and look and sound of the church just really negatively impacts people that have ideas about wanting to be indigenous, which they absolutely should. So another problem that we've seen is that in Siberia they adapted a Russian hymn book that did not meet the needs of at least 2 groups. One of those groups was the youth. A lot of the songs in the hymn book were written during the times of Soviet oppression, when things were very, very difficult. They were definitely persecuted for their faith. And so the songs are talk about a lot of suffering. And the youth today don't want to talk about suffering. For them, that's past history. They didn't live through that. They want more upbeat songs. So the adopted hymn book really did not meet their needs. Another group that didn't really have their needs met by this adopted hymn book were the Sakha people. The Sakha is an indigenous people group. They look Mongolian. They're actually a Turkic language-speaking group, and they're the minority group there. They comprise about 40% of the people of the Republic of Sakha, where we worked. They have a completely different music system than the Russian system. And so their music is very different. And this adopted hymn book really did not suit them as well.
So the result of that sender orientation was you ended up with very anemic youth groups, where it's hard to get your friends to come, and it's very serious and somber, and it's just not very attractive. And so the youth groups grow really slowly. Another problem is the church overall grows slowly because it doesn't look and feel local. When you get into a place where you're out planting churches somewhere, these are signs that this is the mark that's being missed.
So here's where we come to talking about ethnodoxology, that 75-cent word that probably most of you are unfamiliar with, but I hope that you'll feel more comfortable with it after this session. What is the meaning of the word ethnodoxology? Well, let's break it into its three pieces. You see that the first part, ethne or ethno, has to do with cultural or ethnic groups. I'm sure you know that as good seminary students. Doxo, meaning glory or praise. And ology, which is the tack on at the end that usually has to do with some area of study. So we have theology, we have anthropology. This ethnodoxology is the study of what God is doing as far as worship in the cultural and ethnic groups around the world. So ethnodoxology is actually broader than just music and missions. It is actually music and related arts in worship. We're talking drama, the visual arts, storytelling, even architecture, all the performance arts. So my specialty, which is ethnomusicology, is one small part of this broader umbrella of ethnodoxology, which includes all of the performance arts. And when we talk about worship, I also want to make a quick note here that we're not talking about worship just as an event, but it's important to think of worship as a life of worship. That includes things like evangelism and discipleship and service. One other thing that's important to point out about ethnodoxology is it's not just an academic topic of study. It's also very applied. In other words, it has a purpose. It's meant to be applied on the field, either by missionaries or by if you can actually apply the principles of ethnodoxology in your churches here in America. So let's look at the two definitions. There's a long one that's been come up, is on the web that you can find. It's called ethnodoxology, the theological and anthropological study and practical application. So here in the first section, you see the two. You can fill this out on your handout if you'd like. You have the whole study aspect, that it's theological and anthropological. But you also see the second part, that it has a practical application. It's not just study for the sake of knowing. Okay, it's meant to be applied. So the theological and anthropological study and practical application of how every culture might use its unique and diverse artistic expressions to worship the God of the Bible. How every culture might use its unique and diverse artistic expressions to worship the God of the Bible. There's a second definition that's probably a little bit shorter, maybe a little bit easier to wrap your head around, and that is the study of the worship of God among diverse cultures. This definition was of the word is actually the one coined by Dave Hall, who coined the word ethnodoxology. Dave Hall is a Christian worker, and he's the one that coined this word that we have all adopted, the study of the worship of God among diverse cultures.
There is a heartfelt need for ethnodoxology in church planting. Christian workers who understand the biblical principles of mission are hindered in their work unless they include ethnodoxology in their ministry. For Christian workers to understand the biblical principles of ethnodoxology and mission, consider John chapter 4, verse 24, that those who seek God need to seek Him both in spirit and in truth. Seminary is a great place to focus on truth. It's also a great place to think about how can I apply truth to the spirit of people. Be thinking about that as you take your classes and as you go to chapels. It's not just a lot of head knowledge. It's how does that saturate deep into the spirit of a person? Ethnodoxology is very concerned about that. Secondly, Christ's example of the incarnation, he actually came and lived among us. He became one of us. He didn't stay himself a heavenly being, clean and untouchable, and come and live among those people, as we saw in that first video clip. People who are culturally in a bubble and among the people without really being among the people. You understand what I'm saying? For the incarnation to be real in our ministry, we must be reflecting the community in which we serve and not just import something into the middle of that community. And then lastly, 1 Corinthians 9, Paul talked about becoming all things to all men that by all means he might save some. He didn't stay his own cultural Paul, the Pharisee of Pharisees, the one who, when he went into a place, he was absolutely alien and foreign. Instead, he tried to come into a community and as much as he could identify with the people at a level that they could understand and modify his message, not in the truth of it, but in the presentation of it, so that the receptors, with a receptor orientation, they would be able to understand and embrace it. Our choice is not in ministry whether... if we're going to be effective in ministry, it's not whether we are going to use music in our work. We are going to use music. Our choice is how we are going to use music and the arts. If we're going to use it effectively and efficiently and spiritually, or if we're just going to take the easy road and use what we're used to and comfortable with and they can learn to like it. It remains to find those handles which make music work for us in the service of bringing this world to Christ.
But there are hindrances. It's not just the good news of what we should do. The hindrances are actual. And the first one that we'd like to talk about is the hindrance of a lack of priority. Missionaries sometimes think of indigenous or hymns or music as, in general, as more like icing on the cake rather than the meat and potatoes of a tradition. This is a carryover from the North American or Western evangelical tradition, which, of course, is changing in some places. But our tradition is where the spoken word vastly overshadows music and arts in worship. You may have noticed in our culture it's very common for less time to be given to the music than to the preaching. We often cut out verses of the hymn so they make sure to let the preacher speak right on time. In our churches, the preachers are usually paid and the musicians are volunteers. All of these things speak to our values here in Western culture, some of which are changing now. But these Western cultural values are not reflected in many other parts of the world. And increasingly, even in postmodern societies like America and Europe, the proclamation of a truth in a cognitively focused manner is less effective than using music in the arts. So it depends on the culture you go to, but in most cultures around the world, the really effective use of the performance arts speaks to people better than kind of a proclamation orientation. So that's really important. The other thing that's really important to remember is that it's a hindrance when we have a lack of training. There are not very many seminaries or universities that are offering training in ethnomusicology or ethnodoxology. That's one of the reasons why we're so grateful to Southern Seminary for making this a real priority, not just here at the Institute of Christian Worship, but also this summer offering courses this J-term. Historically, missionaries have not put an emphasis on applying their missiology to the arts. Even if missionaries are convinced that it is important and they wanted to do something about it, they don't have the training, they don't have the courses, they don't know where to go to get the tools. So they don't really know how to change the status quo. So in our opinion, ethnodoxology training makes all the difference. It's really, really important. And this is what we felt. We were in Siberia. We were feeling isolated. We knew that this was important to do, but we didn't know how to do it. So we decided to go get some training, and that's when we went to get grad-level training in ethnodoxology and ethnomusicology.
One of the things that we learned in studying ethnomusicology is that music is not a universal language. It is a universal phenomenon, but it is not a universal language.
One of the things that's really important to realize is that it is everywhere, but It's only like language in the sense that it has structure, it has rules, it has intended meaning. So that makes it like a language, but it's not the same rules and the same meanings everywhere. So in other words, music speaks most effectively to those for whom it is a heart language. So that's the basic, bottom, most important principle of ethnodoxology. And to show you some examples, I'd like to play for you some sound examples. And let's see if you can get what the meaning might be of this musical example that I'm going to play for you. Yep. Okay, what do you think the meaning of that might possibly be? Anyone take a guess, just kind of a contextual guess?
What continent is this probably?
Pardon? Praise? Someone feels that it's joyful. Didn't it sound like they were maybe dancing? You heard some rattles?
Okay.
This is from Africa. So it sounds, from our point of view, we would think it's joyful. It was actually the meaning of the words of the song was, he who is carrying a heavy load. So it's exactly the opposite of what we would expect. They're singing a song of comfort for people who are struggling in with their loads in life. Here's another one.
It's not rush hour traffic. What is it?
Any guesses? Ah, confession of sin. I like this.
I often listen to music like that when I'm confessing my sin.
Okay. The bottom line is that this music is their equivalent of pomp and circumstance. It's very, it's music that's meant for large occasions on which they're celebrating a rite of passage, and it's very solemn and very
regal.
Very deeply meaningful to these people. And the words of the song are John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. So not rush hour. I mean, some people would have a hard time even qualifying that as music. Yes. That was from the Vagla culture. That's the Vagla people. Those are Vagla horns. They look like ram's horn, and they're kind of stretched out to the side like this, and they play them in horn choirs. And they are not playing them randomly. It's very specific how they how the horns interact with one another. So that was the Vagla horns. So the bottom line of this is that assumptions of understanding are unwise. You can't just listen to something like that and assume that you're going to understand what's going on. If you study it, you'll understand it, but you can't assume to understand it.
But if you're wanting to create a regal, celebratory moment, this touches their heart. This puts a lump in their throat, like pomp and circumstance might at a graduation ceremony for us.
So what can the study of ethnodoxology do for you? There are many effective resources and strong networks in place to help the ethnodoxologist in his research and in his teaching and in his learning. One of those networks is the International Council of Ethnodoxologists. Bill and I are involved in that organization. I actually helped to found it. Right now we have over 170 members in 70 organizations and in over 50 countries around the world. It's people who do this, and we network through virtual email forums. We also have an online site where you can go to get information about it. There are little green cards out there in the hallway on the table, and you're welcome to take those. Another resource that the International Council of Ethnodoxologists, or ICE, we call it ICE because that's a lot easier to say, we have produced this green CD, and it's an enhanced CD. It has, if you put it in your computer, there's data information that you can pull up all about ethnodoxology around the world. And if you just put it in your CD player, it has 16 songs from around the world that you can just enjoy some ethnic songs. This is also free if you would like to take that. That is at the table there. So this is the benefits of ethnodoxology training. It also helps you to know how to encourage culturally appropriate heart expressions of worship. The course this summer that we are all looking forward to will give you the tools to really do the task.
I'd like to talk about some exciting possibilities that can happen in your ministry when you consider ethnodoxology alongside the preaching of the word and deepening a theological understanding of the congregation. Ethnodoxology trains you to use tools for planting churches, developing ministries that are both biblically appropriate and culturally relevant. And both of those are really important if you're going to reach the minds and hearts of the people you work with.
When we began to use these principles in Siberia in our church planting efforts, we found that it really, really increased the effectiveness of the work. And that is what people around the world have actually found when they use these principles. We found that when we held the Saha people in honor, the ethnic people group there, and gave them positions of responsibility and honored their music and their arts, it really helped them to grow. We noticed that the church plant that we were doing with our fellow Russian church planters grew in its percentage of Saha people. It was the only church that grew in the percentage of ethnic people over the time we were there. Because churches tend to take on a flavor of either Russian or Saha. Our church was about half and half and then grew more and more to reflect Saha people because they felt comfortable praying in their own languages and worshiping and singing and preaching in their own language. This month, we just found out the news that the church that we helped to plant there with that church planting team actually planted a daughter church that is all Saha. They speak, they have decided not to, forbid Russians to come, but they only speak Saha at the church. And so only the people that come are the ones that speak Saha. And they sing in Saha and pray and preach only in Saha. So actually, now there's already a daughter church out of that church plant. So we feel like, also, it helps to meet the needs, the felt needs of the Saha people, because if they feel like it is their church and that they are strongly involved in it, then they begin to reach out and meet the felt needs of their culture, like alcoholism and poverty and some family needs. So that's really important.
It's also a wonderful thing when people go from being passive and difficult to get to church, from that to very active, very excited in putting on outreaches to their own people and sewing costumes and looking for ways to creatively express the gospel. And that takes a lot of meditating on what does the gospel mean and how do we make that understandable to our friends and neighbors. It's a very desirable mindset to have in a church, and it was because of an emphasis on music and the arts that they began to think about how do we process what we have learned into ways that are easy to communicate to others.
One of the things that they did last March was they held the very first ever Saha New Song Festival. There was an outpouring of creative expression. There had been many, many new songs written, and they decided they wanted to present them to the world. So they held this festival. The way it ended up was just amazing. They had experienced a lot of pressure from the KGB. The hall they had rented, their contract was canceled at the very last minute, so they had to hold it in the church. They didn't even have enough room for the Christians to come. Only the non-Christians would come. And you can see by the picture that they absolutely packed the church, even with non-Christians.
All of the people in this picture are not Christians. We invited, by hand-delivered invitation, 2,000 people. About 800 people were expected to attend, and when the hall was closed 48 hours before the event, this is all over the city. People know that it's going to happen. Just a day or so before the FSB, KGB basically, said, close the hall. And so all of the believers in the church hand-walked people over to the church, which only seated about 120 people, and said, there's no room for us to come in, but you enjoy the concert, and we'll see it by video later. And I shot this festival with a three-camera video production. So the Christians didn't get to go to their own festival, but all of these non-Christian people did.
They are also having summer outreaches. There's an ethnic festival every summer, and this coming summer, I'm taking a group of ethnomusicology interns with me to Siberia to witness this ethnic summer Saha festival that the Christians are putting on their own version, and it's a great chance for them to show the world that they're creative as well. If anybody is interested in coming on a trip like that with me, please let me know afterwards. This book that is available out on the table tells stories like this from around the world, and I'd love for you to be able to get a copy. It will be a part of the course materials for the course this summer. It's called All the World is Singing. It has a CD in the back with sound examples so you can hear what some of the stories sound like. You've got to be sure and read chapter 10. That's my chapter. It's a story about Siberia. And so we're hoping you'll get a chance to read that book. Either buy it now, or if you think you're going to be at the summer session, then you'll already have it for this summer. This model has a lot of examples from the world. You'll enjoy reading that in All the World is Singing. And I just wanted to encourage you, if you feel a desire to pursue this discipline, to learn more about it, to find out what are the principles, how you might tie the gifts that the Lord has given you together. Maybe you have gifts in drama or in music or in the visual arts. If you're interested in either using that in your own church or in churches around the world, I'd really encourage you to consider coming to the Ethnodoxology course this J-term. It's going to be June 2 through 6, 2008. And the people that will be teaching the course are the educators from the International Council of Ethnodoxologists. Bill and I will be there, along with Frank Fortunato. You may remember him from last year. Did you? Some of you probably. He was the speaker at ICW last year. He'll be there. Ron Mann, who has also been here at Southern before, will be teaching the Biblical Foundations of Worship section for that. And the course will be titled Ethnodoxology, Connecting Global Worship to Global Mission. So we'd love to have you join us. We'd love to have you spread the word to your friends, to your pastors who are in the area, and have them come and join us. I had just a little small activity that I would like for us to do because we are still forming the course right now. And so we would like your input onto the kinds of things that you would enjoy doing in the course. And as you'll notice, on the back of the first page of your handout, I've listed the course outcomes. There's those 11 outcomes that are right on the bottom of the back of the first page. And what I'd like for you to do right now is you can work together with your neighbor if you want, or you can just work quietly by yourself. I'd like for you to read through those course outcomes. And very simple instructions. If something really appeals to you and you think, oh, I definitely need to do that, put a circle around that number. If there's something you think, oh, you know, this is going to be a great course, but this one number is really not important to me, I could really care less about that, put a check mark by that one. And then I'm going to have you report back to me in about, 5 minutes or so. We're going to take a quick poll, and that way we'll find out what you really want to learn for that J-term course, okay? So I'm going to give you about 5 minutes, probably a little bit less than 5 minutes. Read through carefully. Make it a circle around the ones that are especially interesting to you, and a check mark by the ones that are not so interesting. We could probably skip that.